Page 774. Parshas Ha'aloischa 774. This week's parsha is a combination of a whole bunch of different things. So we'll do an overview, and then we're going to go into two little sections of the parsha. So first, just if you have a look at your handout, the first part of the parsha is the mitzvah of kindling the menorah. So that was a mitzvah communicated to Moshe Rabbeinu to tell Aaron the Kohen that he would have to kindle the menorah every single day. The next part of the parsha is the induction of the Levim. You know that the Levim, there were 22,000 of them, were given special jobs to carry the parts of the Mishkan, to sing in the Beis HaMikdash, to guard the Mishkan, and so on. And they had a special process of being inducted into their service, so that's the part of the parsha. We then have the Korban Pesach and the Pesach Sheni, the famous piece where we are taught that it was the second year after the Jews left Egypt, a year later, the Mishkan tabernacle was established, and then they brought the first Korban Pesach, the first Paschal lamb. But then there were a few people who couldn't do it because they were tamei, they were impure because they had come into contact with a dead body. Some say they were the ones who were carrying the remains of Yosef, and they hadn't had a chance to become properly pure yet with the paraduma, the red cow, and so on. So they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and complained, and they said, why should we lose out on the mitzvah of bringing the Korban Pesach? And that brought out the response of Hashem to have the Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach, on the 14th of Iyar. But if someone couldn't bring the first Pesach, they would have the chance to bring the second Pesach on the 14th of Iyar. Then the parasha talks about the whole system of traveling, how they traveled. The cloud would go up, they would travel, the cloud would come down, they would stop, and so on and so forth. We have the mitzvah of trumpets. Interesting little section of the parasha where Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu that they have to make trumpets, special trumpets that were used in the Mishkan. Later on, actually, they were used in the temple as well. It's interesting. Today, we only know of the shofar. That's the trumpet we use, right? But the times of the temple, times of the Beis Hamikdash, there was a combination of shofar and trumpets. They would sometimes use trumpets, sometimes use shofar, depending on the system, depending on the day, and they would use these trumpets for different things, like on Shabbos, on Yontif, they would blow the trumpets, but also they would blow the trumpets if they needed to assemble the people. It was like a system of assembling the...
Why I'm laughing is because I was just Shavuot at the Vatican Minyan at the Kotel.
Yeah?
And there were the trumpets, not far behind, I couldn't see who was blowing, they were blowing those trumpets, so they were thin ones, and I thought, oh my, what's going on? And I found out much later from people who actually saw it, it was... Those women from the wall or whatever
they were blowing. Oh, they're blowing trumpets. Okay. Yeah, I mean, the problem is, of course, that today we're not permitted to blow trumpets on Yontif. But in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, they would blow these trumpets on Yontif. Okay. Now, there's also the sixth part of the parsha. The parsha goes to what we call the Degalim, the banners. What happened was every... The flags, right. The way the Jewish people camped in the desert, there were 12 tribes, right? But they camped in four sections, and they were called the four Degalim, the four banners. Each section had three tribes, and they would have like a flag that would represent those three tribes. So you have the Degel of Yehuda. So the Jewish people were subdivided different ways. In other words, there was the 12 tribes, but there were also the four Degalim. Briefly, the parasha also talks about the departure of Yitro, the Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, went back to Midian. Then we have, actually I'll just show you this, because we have a very famous piece in the parsha. If you have a look on page 786, I just want to show it to you because we say it every Shabbos, and Mondays and Thursdays actually, and people would remember to know the tune, but... Right, we say when we take out the Torah to read, we sing Vayehi bin Sa, right? Vayehi bin Sa, yeah. So that's in this week's parasha. So the nun's upside down like this. So it's a very interesting little piece. It's kind of inserted here in the parasha out of order. There's a whole reason for it. Why it's here, because there were some negative stories that the Chumash tells us about, and the commentaries say that Hashem put in a bit of a positive thing in the middle to break it up a little bit, right? But those two nuns are actually upside down nuns. You realize? And they're in the Torah itself. They're actually in the Torah itself, in the Torah scroll. 786, right? Verse 35. Right?
Yeah.
It starts with an upside down nun and ends with an upside down nun. Right? Yeah?
I recognize.
Yeah. And they're actually in the actual Torah scroll. Because they're like, it's like
what's
brackets.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like a bracket. It's like a sort of, because it shows...
Where we got brackets from?
Yeah, that's the original brackets. That's it.
In
fact...
Is there anywhere else in the Torah, or is that it?
No, that's it. That's the only place in the Torah you have it, right? So I'm not going to go into why it's there, but I just wanted to point it out because it's interesting. In fact, let me... Sorry? I don't know. It's like a bracket. I don't know why.
It's not like it means anything.
I'm sure it does. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm sure it does mean it. In fact, I'll tell you something very interesting. Every kindergarten child knows that there's five books of the Torah, right? Chamisha Chumashei Torah. There's five books of the Chumash. Well, according to... I'll get more. According to some... Passes down, fill us a lot more. Right. According to some commentaries, there are seven books of the Torah. Do you know that? Why? Because according to some commentaries, the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, which we are in now, is actually divided into three. And it's divided into three with those brackets. In other words, everything until the first upside down nun is considered one book. Those two verses in between those two nuns are considered another book. And then everything from the nun till the end of Numbers, the end of Bamidbar, is considered a third book. So in fact, they're not five books of the Torah, but they're seven books of the Torah. Interesting thing. Anyway, it's just a... Okay. But even so, why?
Oh, it's just a sentence.
It's two sentences. But it's an important two sentences. We say it every Shabbos, right? We take it the Torah.
So
we
make it a book.
Yeah. Well, according to some, it's considered a book. It's going to say that whatever the ramifications are, I don't know. But I'm just saying, it's considered a book, right? Now, okay. It talks about... The reason that we say that we take it the Torah is because it talks about the ark traveling. Right, that's when we open up the ark and we take up the Torah, and the Torah travels around the shul, so to speak. That's when we say that, right? Okay, the next part of the parasha, number 9 on your handout, is it talks about the complaining of the meat. Jews always complain, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And that followed, and that resulted in the appointing of 70 elders, which we're going to go into a little bit later. Then we have the story of the slav of these quails that came down in abundance and people ate them. Number 12, we have at the end of the parasha, we have Miriam talking badly about Moshe Rabbeinu. She spoke Lashon Hara, it's the famous piece, where Miriam spoke a little bit against Moshe Rabbeinu, and she was stricken with leprosy. And as a result, the final part of the parasha is she had to be quarantined outside the camp, and God instructed that everyone should wait for her. And they didn't travel, they were going to travel to the next place, but they didn't travel for 7 days waiting for her to heal. And it was actually considered a reward, because when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, she stood at a distance watching what was going to happen, because he was placed in a basket in the Nile River, and she didn't want to leave him alone, and she stood at a distance waiting to see what was going to happen. So therefore, later on, when she spoke against Moshe Rabbeinu, she was stricken with leprosy, but she was rewarded that they waited for her, because she waited for Moshe Rabbeinu when he was a baby, so she was waited for when this happened. Okay. So, that's just an overview, quick summary of the parasha. What I want to do is go into two little things. The first, I want to just go into the first part of the parasha. If you have a look again on page 774, let's just learn some of the psukim of the parasha. Right? The beginning of the parasha. The Torah says the following: Vayadaber Hashem el Moshe Lamer, and God spoke to Moses, saying, Daber el Aharon, speak to Aaron, ve'amarta elav, and tell him, When you kindle the candles, el mul paneha menorah yairu shiva saneros, towards the face of the menorah, towards the face of the candelabra, the seven candles should shine. What that means is, the menorah was a seven-branch candelabra, right? The middle was the stem, and then the three branches came out of each side. When they lit the candles, and this was a specific way how they had to light the candles, normally you'd imagine that if you're lighting a candelabra for light, you'd want the light to spread as much as possible, right? So you put the wicks facing outside so that the light spreads. But in the menorah, it was the opposite way around. The wicks had to actually face inwards, towards the essence of the menorah, towards the center of the menorah. That's what it means, al-mul paneha menorah. One of the reasons for that is because we are taught that God doesn't need the light. He wasn't asking us to light the candelabra because the temple needed light. It was more of a spiritual thing, and something we'll talk about in a minute, but it was not for his light, so to speak, and that's why they faced inwards. Okay, so that's the thing. So Vayas Kain Aaron. So Aaron did that, right? El Mulpaneha Menorah, opposite the menorah, Nehela Nerasea, he kindled the candles. Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe, as God had commanded Moshe. And then the Torah adds and says, V'zeh Ma'aseh HaMenorah, this is how the menorah, the candelabra, was made. Miksha Zahav, it was one piece of gold. It had to be made out of one piece of gold. It was a very difficult thing to make, because it was a very complicated, intricate design, and yet it was made out of one piece of gold. Ad Yerecha, Ad Pircha, Miksha, from the base to all the flowering and the decorations, was one piece of gold. Kamara Shehera Hashem Es Moshe, it was made like the template, like the vision that Hashem showed Moshe. Kain Asa Samnorah, that's exactly how he made the menorah, exactly the way God had shown him to do. Okay. So, there's a couple of things that I wanted to just go through. First of all, what's the concept of Aaron kindling the menorah? So, we see that the menorah was made out of seven branches, but it was one piece of gold. What's the idea? The idea is, on a spiritual level, we are taught that the whole idea of the Kohen, or in this case, Aaron HaKohen, the high priest, kindling the menorah every day in the tabernacle and the Mishkan, was because what was actually happening was a spiritual concept. What he was doing was, he was elevating and infusing and inspiring the souls of the Jewish people. Why? Because we are taught that there's a pasuk, there's a verse that says, Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam, that the candle of God is the soul of the human being. So every soul is considered like a candle. Just like candles burns with a fire, so to a soul has the potential to have a fire and a love and a for God and a passion and so on and so forth. However, sometimes we need to be inspired. So the concept of Aaron kindling the menorah was this idea of him igniting the souls, of him kindling the souls, right? So why seven? Because we are taught there are seven emotions, as we know, we've taught this many times. And the idea is that everyone is different. Everyone serves God in his or own sort of specific, unique way. Some people, their expression and their connection to God comes from love, the other one comes more from discipline, ambition, whatever the different emotion is, everyone has their different mission, a different role, and different way, unique way that they serve God. And that's all part of the Jewish nation, all part of the souls. And Aaron's role was to ignite every one of the people, each in their own individual way. However, at the same time, the Torah makes sure to tell us that the menorah was made out of one piece of gold. In other words, although we are all different, right? Although we are all different and we all have our own unique individual way, but it's only legitimate when we belong to one piece of gold, when we share values. In other words, the Torah doesn't change. Everyone is different. Everyone individually serves God their own way, but it's only a legitimate individual way when it's based on the same value of the Torah system. And that's this concept. On one hand, it's seven different candles. On the other hand, it's one piece of gold coming from the same base, emanating from the same source, relying and coming and being inspired by and guided by the same code, the same Torah. Right? Now, what's interesting is, there's a very fascinating lesson that comes from this. Because in this parsha, we learn that who was given this mitzvah? Who was given this mitzvah was Aaron. Aaron was the Kohen Gadol, he was the high priest, and he was given the mitzvah of kindling the menorah, which means he was given the role of inspiring and igniting the souls, right? But actually, if you research the laws of the temple, the laws of the menorah, the laws of the Beis HaMikdash, we discover a fascinating thing. That although most things in the temple had to be done by Kohanim, right? In the temple, who did the ritual service? The Kohanim, the priest. So sacrifices, sprinkling the blood, bringing the incense, and so on and so forth. Everything was done with Kohanim. and had to be done by Kohen. If it was done by anyone else but a Kohen, it was invalid. Say someone who wasn't a Kohen, it might have been a great person, but he walks into the temple and he starts being involved in the ritual service, it invalidates the entire service. One of the very, very few exceptions is the kindling of the menorah. Although in this parasha it seems to be given to Aaron HaKohen, but we learn that hadlaka ksheira bizar, that even if a non-Kohen lights the menorah, it was a mitzvah to light the menorah every single day in the temple, even if a non-Kohen lights the menorah, it's still valid. It's one of the rare things that a non-Kohen could do. Right? What's the idea? What's the lesson behind it? The lesson behind it is this. Every service in the temple represents different things. Okay? This particular service represents this concept of inspiring, infusing a soul, igniting a soul, giving passion to someone else. So there are certain things that not everyone could do. That's true. There are certain things to teach very, very deep secrets of Torah, for example, you need a great scholar. To share prophecy, what's going to happen in the future, you need a prophet. Not everyone could be a prophet. Not everyone could be a king. Not everyone could be a Kohen. Not everyone can do everything. Not everyone can achieve the same spiritual achievement as each one. Everyone has roles, and that's part of what we learned in 2 weeks' time in the parasha of Korach. He wanted to be a Kohen, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, it doesn't work like that. Everyone has their role, and it's fine. Yiddishkeit definitely believes in the concept that everyone's mission is different, everyone's role is different. But one thing where everyone could do, notwithstanding their level, or what they might perceive themselves to be, on which level, whatever they are, everyone can inspire someone else. Everyone can ignite a soul. That's what we learn from this parasha. That although the primary role was given to Aaron HaKohen, and his global mission was the ability to elevate Jewish souls, to elevate, to inspire, to ignite, yet we find that this mitzvah of kindling the menorah was kosher even if it was done by a non-Kohen. In other words, it was done by anyone. The lesson being that everyone has an ability to inspire someone else. An amazing idea. It doesn't matter how much knowledge we have. It doesn't matter what level of spirituality we are. Whatever we have, it's always something that someone else doesn't have. We can always encourage someone else. And that's the collective responsibility we all have to not only be inspired ourselves, but to share that passion, to share inspiration, to inspire each other. Okay, that's just a little lesson from this concept. Now, in this paragraph, there's one very famous pasuk with a very, very famous question, which I think we might have touched on previously, but I wanted to go into a bit more detail. And that is, just have a look at verse 3, Gimel. All right. After the instruction is given to Aaron that he's got to kindle the menorah on a very basic level, to actually light the candles of the menorah every single day, right? It says, "Vayas Cain Aaron." Aaron did just that, right? He kindled the menorah. Now, seemingly, it's a bit of a superfluous phrase. I mean, we'd imagine if you got an instruction, he would do it, right? So, Rashi brings a famous saying from the Talmud, from the Gemara. So, what's the Torah trying to say? Aaron did that. Obviously, he did that. What does it mean? So Rashi says that it teaches us it's praising Aaron. How's it praising Aaron? It's praising him that he did what he was told and he didn't change. Melamed shelosh shinah. He didn't change from what he was told to do. Which doesn't really answer the question. I mean, you'd imagine that Aaron was a pretty devout Jew. And this is a very, very famous question. What kind of praise is it? What kind of greatness is it that Aaron, the Kohen, was given a mitzvah and the mitzvah had specific details of what he was supposed to do? And guess what? He actually followed the instructions. I mean, you'd imagine it. If you imagine he should follow the instructions, right? Why should he change the instructions? Why should he do anything different? Yeah? Sorry? Okay, but I mean, yeah, okay, but that was considered a transgression. Yeah, but okay, his sons also, there's a whole other explanation why they did that, but still.
But they were told specifically what to do.
Right, okay, but you don't get... That's fine. But, so you get punished if you do the wrong thing, or they got punished for doing the wrong thing. But you don't get, especially for a tzaddik, you don't have to get specific mention for doing the right thing. I mean, it wasn't very that complicated, right? It wasn't even that difficult. It was a mitzvah of, right?
One of dosenness, I guess.
Okay. I mean, one could, I mean, it's the question that's asked in many commentaries. I mean, why would the Torah specifically add words to praise Aaron for keeping the instructions? I mean, one would imagine shelosh shinah, he didn't change. What does that mean? I mean, he obviously didn't change. Okay. So I'm going to share with you three answers. One answer, I think I've shared this with you before, but it's a very famous and very important answer, actually. And the answer is as follows. What does it mean he didn't change? Obviously he kept instructions. No one ever contemplates a possibility that Aaron wouldn't keep the instructions, keeping them in there. What does it mean? It means the following. We know that there are various mitzvahs that we do at different times, right? So there are certain mitzvahs that we do every day. There are certain mitzvahs that we only do once in a while. Now, even in on a halakhic level, we find an interesting thing that mitzvahs that we do only seldom have a special bracha that comes with them called Shechiyanu. Right? The first time without Chanukah was with Shechiyanu. The first time, why? Because Shechiyanu is a blessing that comes with particular joy. Whenever we have joy for something, we make Shechiyanu. Eat a new fruit, you make Shechiyanu, right? Why? Because the first time you do a mitzvah you haven't done for a long time, there's a certain buzz, there's a certain excitement that comes in the air of doing it, right? But yet, when we do a mitzvah every day, for example, I don't know, we wash for bread every day, or men put on tefillin every day, or whatever, or women light Shabbos candles every week, or whatever the case is, we don't make Shechiyanu. Why? Because the nature of the human being is that something that comes not so often, we get more excited about. Once the novelty wears off, we start to lose a bit of the passion. We might go through the same motions, we might do the same thing, we might keep the same instructions, but we tend to lose the excitement that we had, the passion, the enthusiasm that we had the first time. Here what it says is, Vayas Kain Aaron. Aaron was given a mitzvah to light the menorah every single day while he was alive. Every single day of the Mishkan, he lit the menorah. So the Torah says, Vayas Kain Aaron. Aaron did that. What does it mean? Says Rashi, what the Torah is trying to do is praise Aaron. He didn't change. What do you mean didn't change? Not that he didn't change the instruction. That's obvious. He didn't change the enthusiasm. In other words, the excitement that he had the first day, the very first time he did that mitzvah, he kept the same excitement till the very last time he did the mitzvah. He was excited about serving God and doing the mitzvah every single day as if it was the first time. That's an achievement. Okay? Now, I'll just show you something interesting. A verse in Tehillim. If you have a look at your handout, famous verse in chapter 27 of Tehillim, where David HaMelech, King David, makes a request from Hashem. He says like this, Achas, have a look at the passage. Achas sha'alti me'es Hashem. He says, one thing I've asked of God. King David had one request. Oysa avakesh, and I will continue to ask that of God. What is my request? My request, says King David, is shifti beves Hashem, that I may dwell in the house of God, kol yemei chayai, all the days of my life. I want to be able to dwell in the house of Hashem, he says. Lachazois penoyam Hashem, so that I can see, I can behold the graciousness of God. Ulevaker beheicholoi, to visit His sanctuary, to visit His Beit HaMikdash. Right? What that essentially is a request for the king, because one of the things it means is King David actually wanted to build the temple. He didn't end up building it because he wasn't allowed to. King Solomon did, his son, but he laid the plans for it. Right? He yearned for the day that he could dwell in the house of God and he can come to the temple. But the Mefarshim, the commentaries point out a contradiction within the same pasuk, within the same verse. David HaMelech says, I want to be able to dwell in the house of God all the days of my life. And then he says, I want to visit His sanctuary. You don't visit where you live. Right? It's two separate things. Visiting someone means you visit there as a one-off. Living someone means you live there, right? But they say the answer is, I heard this from my grandfather actually when I was a lot younger. He once wrote to me, Dvar Torah, and he wrote to me this pshat. And he says that he says this is the same thing that we learned here in the Chumash. What King David was asking was the following. He wanted to live in the house of God all of his life. But we all know the difference between someone who stays a very long time and someone who's a visitor. That's the way it is. You know, you get a visitor for the very first time overseas, the first day. There's a big gourmet breakfast for the guy. There's a big tumul, you know, red carpet treatment. Once the guy stays for 3-4 months, I don't know if we treat him the same way. You know, it's getting a bit much already. I mean, okay, he's welcome, but you know. David HaMelech says, no, this is the idea. The idea is like this. He said, I have one request from God. I want to be able to dwell in the house of Hashem all days of my life. But I want to visit His sanctuary. I want the excitement. Every time I come to the Beis HaMikdash, every time I come to the temple, it has to be with the same excitement of a visitor, not with someone who's been living there forever. Same idea. Same idea here with Aaron. He didn't change. In other words, he lit the menorah every single day of his life, but he didn't change the excitement. The last time was as exciting and as passionate as the first time. That's the one answer that's given for this question. I saw a different answer, a completely different approach, but an interesting one nevertheless, about the praise. What was the greatness of Aaron? So there's an interesting discussion in the Talmud about how the menorah was actually structured. The menorah was made out of a kikar of gold. Kikar is a certain measurement of gold, right? It was a very intricate design. It was a base. It was seven branches. It had flowers and all kinds of decorations. And then on the top, it had little candle holders, which would hold the wick and the oil. Right? So there's a discussion whether the candle holders were actually part of the menorah, part of this kikar of gold, or they were a separate piece, an accessory that was made that went on top of the menorah, right? And they were actually taken down. Because there's a whole discussion. One of the things that would take place every day in the temple was the cleaning out of the menorah. Right? Cleaning out of the menorah. Clean out the wicks and the oil, etc. So the question is, did they actually go onto the menorah and when they cleaned it out while it was attached? Or these little candles actually came off and they were clean them and then put them back? So if we take the approach that they were detached, they weren't part of the menorah itself, so then we have an interesting concept. Because there's another Gemara which says the following. The Gemara in Shabbos comments on a pasuk that we have in Chumash, where when they put up the Mishkan, when they erected the Mishkan, when God told Moshe Rabbeinu to erect the actual tabernacle, so it says, "Ha'komoses haMishkan, you should erect the Mishkan k'mishpato, according to its justice, according to its judgment, according to its halacha." And Talmud says, "What does that mean?" So the Talmud says, "What it means is like this." That there were the Mishkan was made out of beams, right? Out of all these lots and lots of beams. When they put up the Mishkan for the first time, so each beam got its place. In other words, sorry?
Beams.
Beams with an M. Wooden beams, yeah, sorry. It's my chaunt of an accent then. Wooden beams. Right. Now, when they put up these wooden beams, right? So what happened was, the first time they put it up, so some beams landed up on the north side, some beams landed on the west, and that's how it happens. Right? You put up a wall, But the Talmud says it actually was all divinely inspired. In other words, the beams that landed up on the north side were supposed to be on the north side. The ones that landed up on the west side were supposed to be on the west side. In other words, each beam had its function, so to speak. Each beam had its spiritual destiny, if one could say it like that, and its spiritual place it had to land up. What's the difference? The difference is that they had to actually code them. That when they took it down and they put it back up, which they did many, many times during their journey in the desert, close to 40 times, because they, whenever they would travel, they would dismantle the Mishkan, and then when they would camp, they put it up again. Right? Whenever they dismantled the Mishkan and put it up again, each beam had to go where it belonged. It had to go back in its right place. It wasn't just like you put it up again so that they were jumbled around. Each beam had to be put in its place that it was originally placed. Okay, so we see this concept that each item in the Mishkan had to go back where it belonged. So now we come to the menorah. What happened with the menorah? If we follow the approach that the little candle holders were actually a separate piece from the menorah, they would be taken down every day and cleaned and then put back. Right? The question is, where were they put back? Says the Chumash, Aaron had a special divine inspiration. He knew where to put them back. Even though they all look the same. So you'd imagine you put them back, not necessarily will they land up in the same candle, in the same branch that they were there yesterday. Says the Chumash Nova, Yas Kein Aaron. Aaron did what he was told. Meaning, Shalosh Shina, he didn't change. Each day when he put back the candle holder, it went on the exact same branch that it was there the day before. Throughout all the 40 years, when he took down the candle holders, he put them back, they went back in the exact same space. Which is a very difficult thing to do. The beams were different because they were coated, but these weren't coated. So that was the praise of Aaron. Not that he kept the instructions, but that he put back the candle holders in the place where they belonged. Okay, that's the second explanation of this idea of why we praise Aaron for not changing. Then there's a third concept. The third concept goes like this, but I need to give a bit of introduction. And this is sort of more of a mystical idea. The mystical idea goes like this. When God relates to us, he relates to the world, there's two types of blessings that he gives us, two types of, they're called shefa, two types of flows of energy that God gives us. One is things that we can deserve, that we can work for. The other is things that transcend our ability and are given to us as a gift, so to speak. What does that mean? When God created the world, he created a finite world. We are finite people. And even if we try very, very hard, and we serve God with all of our abilities and everything that we can possibly do, at the end of the day, we are finite people, right? So when God responds to the mitzvahs that we do, right, there's two ways that He responds to them. Sometimes He gives us a reward or He gives us a blessing, which is relative to the effort that we put in. Okay? But if it's relevant to the effort that we put in, obviously we're talking about a level of blessing which is a bit more finite. Because if it's relative to the effort that we can put in, and we are finite people, so obviously the response that we get is something which can be compared and relates to the effort that we... Yes, it's greater than us, and it's divine, and it's blessing, etc. But it relates nonetheless to the effort that we put in, so therefore it's got some finiteness to it. Okay? But then God promises us that when we do... when we serve Him properly and we do what we need to do, ultimately He will respond and He will give us things that are far beyond us. He will give us a blessing which transcends our ability completely. In other words, what He will give us will be disproportionate to the effort that we put in because it will be completely infinite. Okay. So I'll give you an example from something we just had. We just had the 7 weeks of the Omer, right? And then we had Shavuot, which is the 50th day. Now, if you look in the Chumash, it says that one place it says we should count 7 weeks, right, and then make the festival of Shavuot. Another place it actually uses the expression, it says you should count 50 days. Now, we don't count 50 days, because we only count 49. Shavuot is the 50th day, but on the 50th day we don't count. Why? Because the 49 days of the Omer represent 49 levels of holiness. Right? The idea is that each day we count another day, we refine one part of our personality, and we reach and we achieve a certain level of holiness. Correct? And those levels of holiness have to do with something I spoke about a few weeks ago, which have to do with the different parts of our personality, and we refine a different part of that emotion, and so on and so forth. And we get a response from God, sort of elevating that part of our personality. But the 49 levels all represent levels of holiness that are difficult to achieve, but are within the reach of the human being. Right? The human being is finite. The human being is made up, structured with 7 midot, 7 emotions. Each one is broken down into a further 7. Therefore, it's 49. So the 49, the number 49, represents the ability of the human being. Refined human being, elevated human being, holy human being, we work on ourselves and so on and so forth, but it's the ability of the human being, not more. And that's why we count every day, because what we're able to achieve every day is relative to the effort we put in. It's something we can achieve. We count the Omer, we do what we're supposed to do, we work on our personality to the best of our ability, and we achieve that level of holiness. Shavuot, on the other hand, represents something which is beyond our capabilities. It's the 50th level. The number 50 in Kabbalah is the number of transcendence. It's a number which represents a level which a human cannot reach. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu, we are taught, was one of the most perfect human beings, right? And even he did not reach the ultimate level of the number 50 until he died. It's an interesting thing. You know, if you look at the end of the Chumash, when Moshe Rabbeinu died, it says he was buried on... he went up to the mountain called Har Nevo. Nevo, that's what it's called, Nevo. So in Kabbalah we are told, what does Nevo stand for? Nun Bo. The 50th level was at that point. That's when Moshe Rabbeinu reached the ultimate level of the 50th level. Why? Because even Moshe Rabbeinu on his own couldn't reach the 50th level, only until the day that he passed away, so to speak. Right? So Shavuot represents a response from God which completely transcends our effort. It's not comparable to the effort that we put in. It's a number of transcendence, a number which represents something which is far beyond the capability of the human being. It's the infinite, the transcendence. Right? When Aaron lit the menorah, and this creates this idea of not changing from the instructions, it becomes a whole lesson in this whole idea. When he lit the menorah, what was the menorah represent? What type of flow from God did the menorah represent? So we know that the menorah lit was kindled every day, but it burned miraculously. Why? Because what happened was, the 7 candles in the menorah were lit with the same amount of oil, right? The oil that was put into the menorah was enough to last the night, that's what we are taught. And yet there was a miracle throughout the Beis HaMikdash, throughout the Mishkan, that one of the candles remained burning for 24 hours. It's called the Ner Maravi, the Western candle. I'm not going to tell you which one it is, because there's a whole dispute in the Gemara which one that was exactly, but what's considered the Western candle, but it was one of the candles that burnt miraculously. Why? Because we are taught that the menorah represents an infinite response from God. Menorah represents that type of Eslach Shavuot, is that type of blessing from God that comes in a way which is completely infinite, far beyond the capabilities of the human being. Okay. So then comes the question, the following question. If sometimes God gives us things we don't deserve, which means which are far higher than the things we can possibly achieve, then where does our effort play a role? Where does it come into the equation? Okay. And that's where the model of Shavuot comes into to this whole concept. Because the Torah says like this, you don't count the Omer on the 50th day. Because you can't achieve it. It's not something you can achieve. It's something I have to give you. Yet it's considered the 50th day. And in one place in the Chumash it says to count 50 days. Why? Because the way it works is as follows. There are certain things that God gives us that we cannot deserve, we cannot achieve. But He'll only give it to us after we do what we can. In other words, after we complete the stuff that we can complete, then He responds in a way where He gives us something that we can't achieve. But it comes after we do what we can achieve. Right? And that's the two psukim in the Torah. When one hand the Torah says to count 49, the other hand says to count 50. In other words, the Torah says, when it comes 50, you don't count, because it's something I'm going to give you, it's a gift. It's an infinite gift. But it's an infinite gift only that comes after the 49. You don't get it unless you count to 49, so to speak. See, that's why you have the 49 days of the Omer and then Shavuot. In fact, halachically, the festival of Shavuot is only achieved through counting the Omer. Right? It hasn't got a date. You know, the Torah Shavuot doesn't have a date. Why? Because it doesn't have a date. It's the 50th day of the Omer. In other words, it's the concept where we get something which comes only after we do what we can. And this is the explanation of what it says Aaron didn't change from the instruction. What does it mean? In other words, Aaron was given a mitzvah of kindling the menorah. But when he kindled the menorah, he realized that his effort doesn't really play much of a role, because the response of the menorah is an infinite response. He knows that what the menorah gives us is not what we put into the menorah. So therefore, he could have had a thought, well, if my effort doesn't play a role, if it's anyways this is a gift, so I don't need to be so passionate about what I'm doing, because anyways what I'm getting back is far beyond what I can achieve. And that's what the Torah says, no. We praise Aaron, we say, Vayas Kein Aaron. Aaron did what he was told, he kept with the same passion, because he realized that yes, it's true that what he's going to get back from the menorah is far greater than what he's going to put in, but it only comes after he puts in what he can put in. And therefore that becomes a lesson for us, that when we do what we can do, we need to realize that even though we don't achieve what we get, in other words, what we get is far beyond our achievements, yet it comes only after our achievements, therefore we need to put in our achievements at the maximum effort, because ultimately that brings a response which is far beyond our effort. But our effort plays a big role, because what we get, which is far beyond our effort, only comes after we put in the maximum effort. And that's why Aaron didn't change. He kept the excitement of what he could do, because he knew that although what he kindles, the menorah, is not ultimately what achieves the response, but the response only comes after he does it with his maximum effort, and therefore he did it with a full passion and a full excitement. That's the deep explanation of what it means that Aaron didn't change from what he was told to do. Okay. Now let's have a look at something else in the parasha, interesting thing. It's the appointment of the 70 elders. Let me just give you the background, first of all. 1 second. Okay. The background is as follows. The background to this story is that the Jews came to a place called Tavera, and they had this burning desire for material food, and particularly meat. And what happened was they started to complain about the man, because they were, you know, the Jews in the desert were sustained by the man that fell from heaven every day, the manna. And they started to complain, and they said all kinds of things like, you know, we need meat, we don't have meat. Now, of course, we know that the man was interesting food. The man was this like spiritual, physical food that came down every day from heaven. And they were able to sustain themselves the 40 years of the desert. And it was such an amazing food that it could taste like whatever you wanted it to taste like, apparently. Right? And yet they still complained. Why do they complain? So there were many, many different things. You look in the Pesukim, that everyone complained in a different way. In one pasuk it says, You know, we remember the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlics that we used to have in Egypt, as if they had such great things in Egypt, right? Now, why do they single out these foods? It's an interesting thing that the Talmud says that although the manna had all the tastes of all foods, there were certain tastes it didn't have. Because apparently at that time, these tastes, and particularly onion apparently, was not healthy for pregnant and nursing women. Interesting. I'm not sure what the biology behind that is, but that's what it says. I'm just mentioning it because actually it's a background to an interesting custom which many people have on Shabbos. One of the traditional foods on Shabbos is what they call in Yiddish ayam etzibula, which is egg and onion. Right? I don't know if you know, egg salad with onion. Why do people eat egg salad with onion on Shabbos? Because Shabbos, we know, we do a lot of things to remember the man that fell from heaven. That's why we have two challahs. Right? The two challahs of Shabbos is because on Friday, a double portion of the man would fall for Friday on Shabbos. Why do we do things on Shabbos to remember the man? Because that's how we eat kugel, all the different things we do on Shabbos because of the man. Why do we do on Shabbos specifically? Because interestingly enough, the man didn't fall on Shabbos. It was one day of the week it didn't fall, and a double portion fell on Friday. But yet we are taught that although the man didn't fall on Shabbos, but Shabbos was the source of blessing of the man. In other words, so the blessing of the man came from Shabbos, and then it fell every day of the week. Right. So we do different things to remember the man. So one of the things we do on Shabbos is we eat onion to make up the taste that it didn't have. Because the man didn't have the taste of onions, so that's why we eat onion on Shabbos to make it up. So in some communities, it's considered a very special minhag. Okay. Then they complained about meat. They didn't have meat. They complained they wanted meat. Others said, yes, it's true that the man tastes like whatever you want it to taste like, but there's nothing like seeing what you're eating. You know what I mean? Mm. It's like, you know, it's nothing like having a good meal as opposed to one of these shakes they have these days that have all the protein. You get what you want, but you're still hungry because you didn't eat a good shtickle steak. You know what I'm saying? That's different. Mm-hmm. Others said that the man is great, but it's impossible for us to live this way, that every day we get what we need and we don't know what's coming tomorrow. Right? Imagine, it was an interesting way to live. For 40 years, they always had what to eat, but they never knew when they went to sleep at night, they didn't have anything. Right? In the middle of a desert, they didn't have anything. And the next, they had to trust in Hashem, and the next morning the man was going to fall. So some people felt this a bit hard. Okay. So Moshe Rabbeinu complains. And he complains to Hashem bitterly. He says, I can't bear these people anymore. I can't do the burden on my own. They're impossible. I need help. I need support, etc., etc. Okay, that in itself needs to be understood, why Moshe Rabbeinu needed help and why he would. But the bottom line is he asked for help. He said, I can't feed this whole nation with meat, I can't lead this whole nation. So God says to him, you know what, okay, I'm going to give you some help. I'm going to let you ordain 70 elders who will become prophets like you, but their prophecy will come from your prophecy. And let's have a look at what happens here. Page 790. Sorry? 790.
90 or 99? 90, 790.
Okay. Let's have a look at this. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Sorry, Pasuk Tes Zayin, that's verse 16. Hashem said to Moshe, Esvali Shivim Ish, gather 70 people, Mizikne Yisrael, from the elders of the Jewish people. Asher Yodata, that you know that Kihem Zikne Ha'am V'Shoitrov, that they are the people's elders and the people's officers. V'lakachta Oysam El Oil Moed, gather them to the meeting place, the Mishkan, V'Yatzvu Shom Imach, and they will stand there with you. Then says God, V'yoradeti, I will descend, V'dibarti imcha sham, and I will speak to you there. In other words, I will put onto you a spirit of prophecy. And then, V'atzalti min haruach asher olecha, I will separate, so to speak, or increase, as the English says, I will flow over some of the spirit that's on you, V'samti aleim, and I'll put it onto them. In other words, they will become prophets like you, but the prophecy that they get will be coming from you. They will derive it from you. Right? And then they will gather, they will carry the load of this nation together with you, and you won't carry it alone. Okay. So that's what it says, that the 70 elders were given the spirit of prophecy, but their prophecy came from Moshe's prophecy, and God said, I will separate, I will increase your flow of prophecy and you will flow on from you unto them. Now, I want to just learn with you two interesting passages on your handout. One is from Rashi and one is from the Medrash. It's in Hebrew, but I'll translate it as well. On the bottom of the page and on, okay. So Rashi and the Medrash are both commenting on a similar concept. And the concept is as follows. What we learn here is that Moshe Rabbeinu was a leader, so to speak, gave part of his divine inspiration, so to speak, to the 70 elders, correct? So the discussion in Rashi and the discussion in the Medrash is, does that mean that Moshe Rabbeinu was now missing some of his prophecy or some of his spirit, right? Like, what does that mean? So let's see the comment that Rashi makes and the comment that the Medrash makes. They come at the same conclusion, but they come at it a little bit differently. Let's learn it together. So Rashi says, "V'samti aleim," says Rashi, "Lema Moshe doimer ba'oisa shah." What was Moshe Rabbeinu compared to at that moment? He was compared l'ner shemunach al gabe menorah. He was compared to a candle that's placed on top of a candelabra. And v'hakol madlikin heimenu, and everyone is able to kindle their candle from the candelabra. V'ein oira chaser klum, and yet the light of the candle is not missing anything. Right? Simply, like it's one of these things where you see in the physical world where you can take something from somewhere, and yet the original source not missing anything. So if you have a candle that's lit in a candelabra, and you light a match from that candle, or you light another candle from that candle, the original candle is not lacking any of its light. Right? And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was compared to at that moment. He says he gave from his prophecy, from his spirit to the elders, but yet he was like the candle on the menorah and he was not missing anything. Okay, that's Rashi's comment. Let's have a look at the Medrash comment. Says the Medrash, "V'im toimar." And if you will come and say, says the Medrash, "Hazakeinim shehoisanu v'osan mishol Moshe," these 70 elders, whose prophecy was derived from Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy, "so shema choser Moshe menu v'osay klum," do you think therefore Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, will be lacking from his own prophecy after that? Says the Medrash, "Lav, no." Why? Similar to Rashi, "Lamah hadavar doimer," what is it compared to? "L'ner shohayo doilek," like a candle that was burning, "v'dlikem en kamaneiros," and many candles were kindled from that candle, "v'ord lekosel lechiser," and yet the original candle's not missing anything. "Afkan," so too here, says the Medrash, "Moshe mishaloy lechiser klum," Moshe Rabbeinu was missing nothing. "Shenemar," because it says, how do you know this? How are you so sure, says the Medrash? "V'lekom novi oid v'yisrael k'moshe," because it says there was no other prophet as great as Moshe. That's why. Because at the end of the Torah, we are taught that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest prophet. Okay, so that's the comment of Rashi, that's the comment of the Medrash. Now, this needs to be understood because, first of all, what's the problem here? Why would we think that Moshe Rabbeinu would be missing anything, right? You see, when you talk about a physical thing, okay, if I have a loaf of bread and I give you a slice, yes, I'm missing a slice from my loaf of bread. But that's how physicality works, right? The only place in the physical world where you see that's not like that is by a candle. That's true. A candle is the one area of physicality where you can give to something, you're not missing yourself. But anything that's metaphysical, everything that's not tangible, normally, it's very simple, it's very logical to understand that giving doesn't mean you're missing. Right? If you have an idea and you share that idea with someone, are you missing something then? It's ridiculous. I mean, obviously you're not, right? So when you share ideas or you give knowledge to someone else, right, so on the contrary, you gain from the giving the shiur.
You're not taking from me anything.
No, God forbid, on the contrary. On the contrary, you gain.
You gain knowledge.
Right, you gain. Okay. It's fact. It says in the Gemara that you learn more from your students than you learn from your colleagues, right, and your teachers. So, what's the discussion? Like, why do we think that Moshe Rabbeinu should be missing anything? Right? Number one. Number two, if you look, Rashi sort of says, you know what Moshe Rabbeinu was compared to? He was compared to a candle on a candelabra. Who cares where the candle is? I mean, like, what? Why did you say? Simple. He was compared to a candle lighting other candles and he's not missing anything. What's the elaborate analogy that he was like a candle on a candelabra. So what? And also, if you look at the Medrash seems to be battling with this whole thing. The Medrash doesn't say it was like a candle on the candelabra. He says just like a candle lighting under candles. But the Medrash says, I'm going to prove to you that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't missing anything, because it says at the end of the Chumash that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest prophet. In other words, if it wouldn't say in the Chumash that Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest prophet, I would assume that Moshe Rabbeinu was missing something. But why? Why would he be missing anything by giving some of his prophecy to the elders? What are we missing here? What point did we overlook here? So I'll do a show with you an interesting little explanation from the Bavitcher Rebbe in one of his talks on this parasha. He says the following. He says actually it's not so simple. He says it's not so simple that when you give to someone you don't lack even in a spiritual thing. So he says there's three levels of how this works. He says when a person explains a concept to someone else, right? Let's say a teacher and a student. When a teacher explains to a student a subject, so it's true that the teacher is not lacking anything. But why? On the contrary, what happens is the teacher sometimes gains even more clarity. Because what happens is, normally when we have teachers and students, the teacher, he might know more than the students, maybe. Right? But he's not in a completely different category. In other words, he's teaching students who he can relate to. Why can he relate to them? Because he's got the same brain as them. He's got the same background as them. He's the same world as them. He comes from the same world. In that world, he knows more. They know less, so he's got to explain it to them. So he brings it down a little bit more tangible. He makes it a bit more thing, right? So when the teacher has to explain a concept, which to begin with, this concept is a concept which is applicable to the student. He's teaching the students things which he can impart to them, because it's in their world, in his world, right? He knows a subject, they can also learn the subject. Okay, they don't know it as much as he does, but nevertheless, he can explain it to them. So then it's like a candle lighting another candle. It doesn't actually lack anything. He's not missing anything by explaining. On the contrary, by explaining it, maybe he gets more clarity. But then you have a concept that's explained sometimes when you have a teacher and a student that are completely what we call in Hebrew ein arach. In other words, there's no comparison between the two. They come from completely two different worlds. I don't know. A scientist that is a scientist, a brilliant, world-renowned thing, and he's talking to a grade one class. And he got stuck in a grade one class teaching them mathematics. I don't know if that's a good analogy or not, but let's say, right? So for him to teach it, it's not just a matter of taking a concept that he knows that he could teach to them, that then needs to be brought down and made clear for them. It means a whole shift in his mind. Right? It's a whole shift in his mind. He actually has to shut down his own way of thinking and has to sort of find within his thinking something that he can relate to the student, which is not in his world altogether. And when he does that, he is lacking. Because he has to leave his world. If he has to leave his world and descend into the world of the student, descend into the world of the person who he's learning from, for those moments that he descends into the world of the student, he's unable to live in his world, he's unable to process meaning and knowledge within his reality. And therefore he does lack, he is harmed, so to speak. It might be an important thing to do, he might gain spiritually, but he is lacking. He's giving of himself, he's giving up something. Understand? When a teacher and a student teaches, they both come from the same reality, both from the same world, just one knows more than the other, then the teacher isn't giving up, he's just becoming more clear. He hasn't left his world, so therefore he's not giving up anything. When a teacher teaches a student where the student is a completely different culture, background, perspective, and he's got to descend into the world of the student, the teacher has to give up something in order to do that. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, being such an unbelievable prophet, when he gives of his prophecy to 70 elders, right? He's not like the teacher who's in the same world as the student. He's like the teacher who's in a complete different world. Moshe Rabbeinu is on a whole different level. And therefore, says the Medrash and Rashi, are bothered, does that mean that Moshe Rabbeinu is giving up something? If he is now leaving his world to relate on a prophecy level to 70 elders who can become prophets but from a completely different world to Moshe Rabbeinu, Does that mean he's going to give up something? Does that mean he's going to have to give up some of what he's living in order to relate to the world that they're living? That's the issue. In other words, we could assume that maybe he has to give up something, like the teacher who gives up when he leaves his infinite world to descend into the finite world of the student. So both Rashi and the Medrash come to the conclusion and say, no, he didn't give up anything. Which is a novel thought. Why? Why is two opposite reasons. Rashi has one reason, and the Medrash has a completely different reason. Rashi's reason is, because Moshe Rabbeinu at that moment was like a candle on top of a candelabra. What's the candelabra symbolize? The candelabra is like the recipient, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was from a whole different reality. His level was completely different. But not at that moment. At that moment he was in the world of the recipient. He descended. Moshe Rabbeinu suffered himself a loss of level then. Why? Because we learn that Moshe Rabbeinu's greatness was taken because he was the leader of a great people. And it's an amazing thing this, that when the Jews sinned, it affected Moshe Rabbeinu's greatness. And therefore, at that moment that the Yidden were complaining and they were rebelling against God and complaining against God, they lost some of their greatness, and because of that, Moshe Rabbeinu lost some of his greatness. And therefore, says Rashi, at that moment, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't like the teacher who's in a different world. Because at that moment, he lost some of his greatness. Just like we find by the golden calf, when the Jews sinned by the golden calf, Moshe Rabbeinu was up on the mountain and God said to him, go down. And Chazal tell us, the Gemara says, what does it mean go down? Not just physically go down the mountain, means go down from your greatness. You know, you can't be as great as you were till now because your flock are not as great. Leaders are affected by the people they lead. It's an interesting thing. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu was like a candle in the menorah, in the recipient. It was in the world of the recipient because he had descended. And therefore, when he taught at that time, when he gave up from his prophecy, he wasn't losing anything. But it came from a negative, not from a positive. Had he been infinite like he always was, he would have given up something. That's Rashi's way. The Medrash says the opposite way around. The Medrash says, you know why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't give up anything? Because there's no prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu. You know why? Because there's a third level. And the third level is like this. You have the teacher that's in the same finite world as the student, just greater. So he doesn't lose anything when he teaches because he's just in the same world. You have the teacher who has to think, he thinks on a different level altogether. So when he relates to the student, he has to descend into the student's world and he is giving up something. You know why? That's because that teacher is great, but his greatness is limited by the fact that he's so great. In other words, he lives in his world of infinity, but he's bound by that world. He can only think quantum physics. He can't think grade 2 maths. He just can't. So if he has to, then he has to give up something. Right? But then you have the greatest teacher of all is the teacher that can handle both things at the same time. The greatest teacher, the teacher that can relate to the small student and yet not give up anything because he's so great and he's so able to comprehend anything at such a great level that he can comprehend things at the same time, that he can give to another world and at the same time retain his greatness. And that was Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's why the Medrash says that in case you think Moshe Rabbeinu had to give up anything, he didn't. You know why? Because it says in the Pasuk there was no great prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu. His prophecy was so great, it wasn't even limited by his infinity. In other words, he could be finite and infinite at the same time. He could give to the 70 elders and yet retain his greatness. And that's why I didn't. But the bottom line is that both Rashi and the Medrash, but from two different opposite points of views, are saying that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't give up anything and remained the same Moshe Rabbeinu, but two different perspectives. Okay.